Robert Wood, and his experience with documents is second to none. And so typefaces, typewriters, paper, the dating, how things are structured on government documents and how they're titled and the flow. And there were certain standards, you know, tied with everything. He knows what he's looking at. You know what I mean? And so how does he feel about Tompkins' documents?
As far as Tompkins' documents are concerned, the authentication process is still at an early stage. I mean, what he has in his possession are copies of Tompkins' original documents. But we're talking about original letters or other documents that Tompkins gained during his long career in the aerospace industry. So these are things that are not that difficult to verify in terms of authentication. One of the things that we are working on now is to kind of like identify the Navy admiral that was running the espionage program out of the Naval Air Station out of San Diego,
right,
from 1941 to 45. His name is Admiral Rick Obata, according to Tompkins. And Tompkins has passes that were personally signed by the admiral that allowed Tompkins to leave the Naval Air Station facility with which, yeah, is very strong confirmation that Tompkins was in fact carrying intelligence briefing documents to other locations as he claims. But the thing is, in trying to do any kind of open source inquiry into Admiral Rick Obata, we've hit a dead end. We can't find him. According to Tompkins, Obata was part of Navy intelligence, and they're very good at kind of like whitewashing people. This is why what happened with Obata. So that's one of the things that we're trying to do now, because those passes Tompkins has are very important in substantiating his testimony, and of course they are signed by a person who was running the Navy's intelligence program. So we have to do some kind of document verification in that case, and I'm hoping that as I begin to go through this list of Navy officers from that dates from 1985. That some of those people will have some information about Obata and the Navy intelligence program that was put in place to deal with extraterrestrial life.
Hi, you're live on Fade to Black. Say hi to Michael Sala. Who's calling?
Hey, Mike. Hey, Jimmy. It's John in New Hampshire.
Hey, John. How are you, man?
Not bad. Not bad.
Great.
Cooking dinner.
Great show tonight, huh?
Yeah, it really is. It's an awesome show. I'll take my answer off air because I'm cooking right now.
Okay.
But I was just curious if the Greys had anything to do in between the Nordic and the reptilian agenda with the Nazis and the Americans during World War II, if they have ever come up at all in your investigations or anything.
Sure. Great question. Thank you.
Yes, that's an interesting question. Tompkins never mentioned the Greys. He basically just talked about the reptilians. He talked about the Nordics. And I didn't raise the topic during our interview. I don't recall seeing it in the book. But that the book deals with Tompkins' life up until 1970. I think that when it comes to Tompkins being involved in this Navy extraterrestrial education program, that's probably where the different races will be mentioned and where the Greys will be mentioned. And that's probably where he'll talk about that in his subsequent book, or the next time I get to see him, I can say, well, you know, who were some of the other races that the Navy was aware of?
Hi, you're live on Fade to Black. Say hi to Michael Sala.
Hi, Jimmy. Hi, Dr. Sala. How are you doing? I don't want to ask a hostile question. We're really enjoying your knowledge here. But one thing that keeps pissing me off is whenever I hear about, poor Phil Schneider, the engineer, who was one of the first people to really come out in a big public way and talk about these underground bases and such, and what was done to him. I mean, what many of us believe, he was murdered. And here you're maybe because you're not an American, you were never attacked or shut up. I mean, look what they did to him. And I guess that's the second part of the question. What do you know about underground bases around the world and what's going on there?
Thank you for the question.
Just to kind of correct you there, yes, I did actually pay a price. I was a full-time university professor when I got involved in this issue, and within 3 years of me becoming involved in this research, I was kicked out of the university system. Basically, all of my research, my PhD, all the grants meant nothing because I couldn't find a job in a university anymore, because now my name was blackened because I was a researcher of extraterrestrial life. So I have paid a very significant price here. I'm still alive, thankfully. Unfortunately, Phil Schneider, they kind of did what they did to him in 1996. What do I know of underground bases? I think the information that both Corey Good and Tompkins have revealed substantiates many of the things that Phil Schneider said. And that I think history will be very kind to Phil Schneider, that people will basically look at him and say that he was a truth teller, someone who was eliminated because he was spilling the beans on these underground programs. And that unfortunately he went active at a time when there really wasn't any protection for whistleblowers who were revealing this kind of information. It was only in 2001 with Greer's Disclosure Project that there seemed to be a lot of protection for whistleblowers to come forward. And Stephen Greer highlighted that none of the 400 or 500 or so whistleblowers that he personally interviewed, none of them have been harmed as a result of their disclosure. So I think basically 2001, there was a major change in terms of the protection that whistleblowers would get for revealing what they knew.
Hi, you're live on Fade to Black. Say hi to Michael Sala. Who's calling?
Hi, Michael Sala. This is North Carolina, Jimmy.
How are you?
Hey,
Missy.
I am well. Well, sir, I hope you are. I hope you are well.
It's all good.
So I've been listening, and I just keep wondering what it would be like to be you, Mike. And I'm wondering, with all that you have seen with your own eyes and perhaps touched or held in your hands, what drives you and what you do, what would you be maybe the most compelled to say to those of us that are lending you our ear at this moment? I'm interested to know what you think would be the message, perhaps, from you to yourself there.
That's interesting, and thank you for the call, Missy.
Thanks.
Yeah,
sure,
Mike, what drives you?
I'm an educator by profession. That was something that was very important to me and continues to be important to me. As I mentioned, I was a university professor, and I was very interested in revealing what was going on around the world as far as the things driving international conflict, because I, like many others, we want the world to be a more peaceful place, and so global peace was something that really drives me, and so that was what drove my research. And when I became involved in this extraterrestrial phenomenon, I really saw it as being something that if it people could be educated as to what was really going on behind the scenes with all of these extraterrestrial projects, we could make the world a better place and promote world peace through the disclosure of this information. And so that's a very powerful driving force for me because, yes, I very much believe in world peace, and I think that as we disclose this information, as people are educated about these advanced technologies, about the presence of extraterrestrial races and about these different space programs that are being put into place, that we ultimately can make the world a more peaceful place, a better place where everyone is going to be uplifted and experience things that they could scarcely dream of. You know, what Corey Good describes as a Star Trek society, I think that's certainly at a minimum what we can achieve. We could probably achieve even more than that.
Did Tompkins have any kind of list with references to, like, not only Corey, but maybe Mark Richards or other secret space program guys? And, Gary McKinnon, you remember Gary McKinnon when he was talking about this exact thing, off-world Air Force commanders and so forth. This is exactly what he was referring to. And did Tompkins know of this and the secret space program specifically?
Tompkins was not aware of the operational aspects of the Solar Warden program at the time of there are different phases in Tompkins' career. I mean, he was first involved in the kind of design and the development of the Solar Warden program, and then he was involved because Solar Warden, according to Tompkins, went operational in 1984, which again matches with what Corey Good has said. In 1985, Tompkins began working for the Navy League, and he was in a leadership position with the Navy League from 1985 up until 1999. It was an educational program, so he was involved in that. And that's where he had a list of Navy officers who were involved in this extraterrestrial educational program. And some of that would have, I guess, involved the operational aspects of the Solar Warden program, but at least from the perspective of the extraterrestrials who were out there in space, you know, talking about how the Nazis had joined in with the reptilians in conquering different Nordic worlds out there in the galaxy. So that was part of the history that certainly was being taught. And so Tompkins was aware of that. As far as the current operational aspects of the Solar Warden program is concerned, and of course Corey Good refers to it as the Secret Space Program Alliance, because the Solar Warden program has been augmented by the defections of units associated with other space programs when this blockade went into effect around the solar system in early 2005. Tompkins is aware of that, and he's been given access to some briefings on the current operational aspects of Solar Warden. He's mentioned some things, but at the moment he hasn't given me the go-ahead to talk about that.
Where do you think do you think that Greer, and I know that you guys are friends and we're friends, but do you think that he's handled it the right way to push for disclosure? Then you have, you know, Stephen Bassett and his, you know, his push and the way that he's dealing with it. And we're still not, you know, pretty much any closer to any official response. What's the best way to go about this, or has it already happened?
Well, Greer really has done a phenomenal job in putting together all of these video and recorded testimonies of the various whistleblowers he has interviewed over the years. You know, this is primary source data that helps us understand the big picture. So he really has done a great job in putting that together and in lobbying Congress to take action on this. And I believe that Congress and various people in the programs took Greer very seriously because they recognized that he was someone that was, in fact, being helped by a group of extraterrestrials. Unfortunately, and this is where I part company with Stephen, is that he does have a filter, and unfortunately it's a filter that basically says that the only extraterrestrials...
We lost you, Michael. Okay. You need to repeat. Hold on, Michael, listen. Repeat everything from Stephen has a filter forward.
Sure. Stephen has a filter where he believes that there are only positive extraterrestrials that exist, and that any whistleblower talking about negative extraterrestrials is part of a disinformation campaign. That's very unfortunate because that's his filter, and it means that he doesn't seriously consider alternative whistleblower testimony to what he has in his database. And actually he filters out some of the testimony of the whistleblowers that he actually did interview that did talk about this negative extraterrestrial presence.
Yeah, and he's pretty, I want to say this in a nice way, he's pretty strong about it too. He does not bend when it comes to that, and he will, I'm trying to be polite here. He won't consider anybody else's opinions on this, and I find that unfortunate too as well.
Well, the thing is that since Stephen Greer did that pioneering work with getting all of these whistleblowers to come forward, there have been quite a number of other whistleblowers who have come forward. Of course, the Project Camelot, Kerry Cassidy, Bill Ryan, researchers like Paula Harris. I've also been able to get a few new whistleblowers to come forward. These new crop of whistleblowers who have come forward have been able to offer a kind of more unfiltered perspective on what is really going on. So, you know, Stephen Greer's corpus of whistleblowers give us a valuable information of what's going on. And then since 2001, there have been a lot of other whistleblowers who have come forward. Not all of them, nearly as accurate as I believe Corey Good and William Tompkins are. But nevertheless, they do reveal some important information.
What's next for you?
Well, I'm just going to continue doing this work, investigating the Bill Tompkins case. There's another whistleblower who has come forward who has also worked with Navy intelligence. He worked out of Moffett Airfield in San Francisco at the Naval Air Station there from, I believe it was 1986 up until 1989, and he had access to thousands of documents. So trying to get in touch with him. MUFON has his report, and hopefully I'll be able to collaborate with the people in MUFON to compare his documents with William Tompkins and do the cross-referencing, because they have very similar backgrounds, having worked with naval intelligence out of these air stations doing these debriefings of information concerning aerospace programs, and then disseminating that to different programs, which again is kind of similar to what Philip Corso did with Army Intelligence, with the Research and Development Branch out of the Pentagon from 1961 to 63. So it seems that there have been multiple programs of disseminating this technology that Navy or Army intelligence has gained through its various assets to various aerospace corporations. So I'm going to be doing the work in cross-referencing these different Navy intelligence assets with the documents that they have in their possession and kind of see how all of that comes together with what Corey Good and other whistleblowers have said about the secret space programs.
One last phone call. Hi, you're live on Fade to Black. Say hi to Michael Sala. Who's calling?
Hello, Mr. Sala. This is Allison. And I just have one question, and I'll take my answer off the air. I was curious to know if Mr. Tompkins spoke or had anything in his information about the inner Earth contingent that Corey Good talks about. I know they were talked about from the German contingent, and I was just curious if there was any linkages there. Thank you.
Thank you
for all the wonderful work you do, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Allison.
Thanks, Allison, for that question. William Tompkins has only referred to extraterrestrial bases, subterranean extraterrestrial bases, whether they're Nordic or whether they're reptilian. Also, subterranean bases that have been created through the different space programs, whether it's the Nazis or the Navy or the other branches of the U.S. military. This is something, and interesting in that you also mentioned that underground facility off the coast of Malibu that I know you kind of helped break that case, Jimmy.
Yep.
I followed your work in that case. So, yep. So that was something Bill Tompkins also said, that yes, there's a underground Navy base there. But
Wait. Tompkins mentioned the Malibu base directly?
Yes, he said that there was an underground facility off the coast of California.
Uh-huh.
I mentioned Malibu, and he said that, yes, that was something that he was familiar with.
Really?
That's right. So he was basically confirming that structure that you helped reveal or
right.
disclose to the public, that was something that the Navy uses as an access into its underground facilities that it has under the Pacific and under the West Coast of the United States.
Okay.
The Navy does have those.
I can't have you leave on that note. You want to hang for 10 more minutes after the break?
Sure.
Yeah, I've got to talk about this. You just blew my brains out onto the studio walls here. This is Fade to Black. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Tonight, Dr. Michael Sala is with us. And I guess we're going to come back and talk a little bit. Talking about Phil Schneider earlier, I would have loved for him to have been around, for the Malibu conversation and the reveal. And what he might have known about that, too, as well. And it's interesting that Bill Tompkins mentions it. Do you think he was did he reference the Malibu base as we know it, as you know it? Is that what he was talking about?
At the time, he was talking about these underground bases that the Navy had access to, that there was a kind of a network of these underground facilities that had been built a long time ago, and some of them were being used by the Navy. And so I just said, well, there's a facility off the coast of California around Malibu, several miles out, that was publicly discovered, and is this an example of the kind of base that the Navy or entrance to an underground facility that is being of use? And he said, yes, that was an example of something that was being used. I did get him on tape, so I'll have to kind of go through that again to get his exact response to that, to be precise in my answer. I don't want to misattribute something to him. But definitely, yes, he said that there was something off the coast of Malibu that was an entrance to the underground system in the United States, that maybe submarines could travel through that.
We have, and myself personally too as well, I have spent days until my eyes were burning purple. I've looked on every coast of every piece of land on planet Earth looking for something similar to what we found off the coast of Malibu. Okay, it's just something similar. Nothing. And I'm talking about up and down the coast of the east coast of Russia, China, all the way through to the Mediterranean, the Indian Sea, India, around Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Greenland, United Kingdom, Baltic, Black Seas, Dead Sea, every piece of coastline, and including Antarctica, and have not found anything that remotely resembles what we found off the coast of Malibu.
Well, that's right. There's definitely access points for the Navy in terms of testing its facilities, or testing its submarine fleets, and to be able to access facilities inland. And I think the most important one was the China Lake facility.
Yep.
That you can, if you can draw a line from that Malibu point, it's really possible that there is an access point to China Lake. And you know, we know China Lake is the biggest naval kind of testing facility in the United States. That was also the place where Tompkins says he was taking his intelligence briefings from the Navy spies to China Lake, that Caltech had a facility there or was helping the Navy with its R&D. The Nazis were able to use basically the Nazi space program kind of was had piggybacked on what the Nazi Kriegsmarine or the submarine fleet or the Navy was doing rather than the Air Force. So, you know, people look at the Luftwaffe as being the place where the Nazis were making these breakthroughs, but no, they weren't. It was the Kriegsmarine, it was the German Navy, and it was the submarine fleet, because it actually makes sense, because when you're thinking of sealed submarines that could stay underground for extended periods, that's very similar to developing spacecraft that could go out there. So the Navy was doing this, and the Navy the German Navy was very expert in finding these underground locations that they could access using submarines. And I think that at some point the U.S. Navy had done something similar, and certainly there are access points in Antarctica that the Nazis had found, and according to Bill Tompkins, there are access points underwater into the U.S. continental shelf, and that Malibu facility was one of them.
The stories, you know, it's the old adage, right? Where there's smoke, there's fire. And the story that goes back, I think it's in 1960s, there's a couple of Navy guys that are at an airport in Las Vegas. They get spirited away, taken out into the middle of the desert, right, dropped off, and a hatch opens. They go and they go down, and they jump on a submarine, and they go to the coast of Malibu, right, and they pop out in Malibu. It's there's lots of stories like that. There was something else. Oh, we were talking about China Lake. China Lake is the largest Navy base in the world, and it's in a desert. It is huge, and it's in a desert. And one would have to ask, why? Well, if you have the Malibu entrance right there, and you're right, you draw a line, and it's so close. Most people don't realize how close China Lake is to Malibu, and it's right there. It's right over the mountains, and if you continue north off of China Lake in a straight line, you hit Area 51. That's another interesting take.
And the interesting thing here, Jimmy, is that if Tompkins did go to China Lake to deliver these debriefing packages on the Nazi flying saucer technologies. And so China Lake is where Caltech was working for the Navy in basically developing or reverse engineering these Nazi craft. And so these Nazi craft, as I mentioned, kind of like doubled also as submarines. And so from China Lake, developing the technologies that the Nazis had pioneered from China Lake, you could basically use these underground tunnels to test these prototype models that were being developed by the Navy out of China Lake. So I think there's definitely a connection between China Lake, the development of the early prototypes, flying saucers, and then what's off the coast of Malibu there.
Yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I as a kid, like yourself and most young men, when you look at the Nazi war machine and you just look at it compared to what everybody else was doing at the same time around the world, I don't want to discredit Nazi scientists and say that they weren't smart and that they weren't good at weapons development, but everything that they had was light years ahead of everybody else. And you just have to stop and ask yourself, where did they, I just hiccuped, where they got this vision. It was just so different than what everybody else was doing. In an economy that was severely taken back after World War One and nothing but recovery, and they just boom, just everything that they did was so different and so forward thinking.
Well, keep in mind here with the Nazi technologies that were being developed during the war is that, the Nazis got so close to winning the war with conventional military armaments that were being constructed very quickly in occupied Europe during the height of these massive aerial bombing campaigns. But at the same time, in Antarctica, the Nazis were moving forward with these anti-gravity technologies without any kind of interference at all from the war. So from early 1939, which is when the first Nazi base was established in Antarctica, up until Admiral Byrd's Operation Hijab in December of 46 and January 47, the Nazis had basically 8 years of uninterrupted development on their anti-gravity technologies, and so they just got so far ahead so that when Operation High Jump tried to basically assert control over what the Nazis were doing down there, they just got blown out of the water.
Did Tompkins have any references directly with the Bell, the Nazi Bell?
I didn't talk to him about the Nazi Bell. What he did say was that there were 30 different Nazi prototype craft.
Oh, we lost you, Michael. I think we lost Michael for real this time. Are you still there, Michael?
Yes, very interesting synchronicity there. But as I was saying, that the Nazis were developing all different types of propulsion systems. One of the systems that they developed was a kind of teleportation, a dimensional phase-shifting technology. That was one of the things that the Nazis were trying. And also that the U.S. Navy was also doing. Tompkins did talk about the Philadelphia experiment, that was kind of something related to what the Navy spies were relaying back from Germany.
When do you think he'll be ready to go full tilt, maybe television or speaking at conferences and so forth? Is he ready for that? Is he prepared for it, I should say?
Well, you know, I mean, he is, he's 92, and he's physically okay, but, you know, definitely he's not someone that could be easily kind of subjected to long air flights and so forth. So I think that, I mean, as people can invite him to attend conferences and so forth, but I'm not sure if that is something that he can easily do. I know he did attend a conference, the West 2016 conference, which is the premier naval conference. Every year they hold that, where the top aerospace companies come together and talk about their products and their plans. And so he did attend that, and you know, some interesting things happened there concerning the Solar Warden program, that he at some point hopefully will be ready to reveal. So I think he's definitely capable of doing a public lecture, but I don't think anything too rigorous. Probably easier for him to just do kind of telephone interviews.
Did really quick, because we're at the end of the show, did you ask him about Mark McCandlish and the ARV, the alien reproduction vehicle? Did he know anything about that?
No, I didn't ask him about that. He's just kind of like, we just, there were so many documents that he had, and you know, we were just focusing on those documents and, you know, what they meant, what their relationship was to, you know, the various projects.
And what about his top secret clearance and his signing of that, you know, 10 years in prison, $10,000 fine and so forth. Has all of that expired? Is he bound by any secret oaths?
Well, that's the interesting thing, Jimmy. He still has his top secret clearance.
Right.
You know, when he went to that West 2016 conference,
right,
he was able to access a classified briefing using his documents. So he is still kept in the loop. He is still a consultant for the Navy on this subject matter, which is very interesting because, as I mentioned, he's been officially retired from the aerospace industry since 1984, but then he did work with the U.S. Navy League from 1985 up until 1999, and then in the year 2000 he moved to the San Diego area and has been since playing this consultant role where he says even though he's not paid, they still call on him to be a consultant and keep his security clearance valid. And he's disclosing this information with the full awareness of the Navy, and as I said earlier, he has said explicitly that he is part of a U.S. Navy sanctioned disclosure initiative beginning in 2001.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much, Mike.